L'oro che fece risplendere l'Egitto del nuovo regno. Questo è il titolo del dialogo al quale state per assistere e che si inquadra nella più ampia iniziativa Aspettando Biennale Tecnologia 2024. Questo dialogo è stato realizzato in collaborazione tra il Politecnico di Torino e il Museo Egizio di Torino e a questo proposito desidero ringraziare sentitamente il direttore del Museo Egizio, il dottor Christian Greco, per la sua preziosa collaborazione. I due relatori ci accompagneranno a comprendere come l'oro ha svolto un ruolo primordiale nello sviluppo della civiltà egizia, a partire da come veniva estratto, poi trasformato e quindi il suo impatto sulla economia e sulla società di questa grande civiltà. Quindi verrà aperta una interessante e coinvolgente finestra sul passato, ma che ci porterà anche a riflettere su quello che è il nostro presente, perché ancora oggi le materie prime hanno un'influenza importantissima sull'economia, sulle società, su quelli che sono gli equilibri geopolitici del mondo. I due relatori che ci accompagnano in questo percorso sono due personalità di alto profilo: il dottor Johannes Auemüller, che è curatore del Museo Egizio dal 2020 e che insieme a numerose altre expertise ha anche un'esperienza profonda nella lavorazione nei metalli e nella fusione del bronzo nella periodo faraonico. E l'altro relatore è il professor Alessandro Giraudo, che è docente presso due grandes écoles parigine, economista e autore di libri notissimi sulle materie prime, sulla loro storia e sul loro impatto sull'economia e sulle società. Nel ringraziare i due relatori per il loro prezioso contributo e tutti voi per il vostro interesse ed attenzione, vi auguro una buona visione.
Okay, so it's a great pleasure to be here with you all, and particularly with you, Alessandro Giraudo, to speak about the topic that you see behind us here on the screen. We are going to talk in English, but this is in Italian, but if I may translate it, we are talking about the gold that made the splendor or that made Egypt splendor in the New Kingdom.
Great. So, it is a very special moment for Egypt because, for a long time, Egypt was a very important dynasty, set of dynasties, and an important power. But as of the beginning of the 18th dynasty, they were able to have a couple of very important expansion activities, so military activity, and they were able to occupy the region south of Egypt, that means Nubia. And for your information, as you know, Nubia means Nub means gold in local language, and this means
I might, in this case, indeed
you
have something
something
to immediately to
okay
discuss because this is
good.
indeed a very important topic.
Sure.
In the literature, one often finds the equation that the toponym Nubia derives from the ancient Egyptian word nub,
Noob, right?
which stands for gold. But our pronunciation of the word noob is more or less wrong because in ancient Egyptian it was pronounced nebu,
Nebu.
and there are more recent studies of, let's say, linguists who think that the term Nubia has etymologically nothing to do with
The
gold,
goal.
but it's only the local ethnonym of people who spoke a Nubian language, namely Nobiin, and they use the term Nob for their self-identification. So Nob means the Nubian, but the link with gold has recently been disputed, but in the literature it's found over and over again and repeated
True.
because this relationship seems so obvious, but in the end it might not
It might
be
not be,
as we
and I would like to
believe. So,
counterattack you,
yeah.
because probably you know that all the people that were working the gold, so not miners, but people that were goldsmiths in reality, and they were called the Nubi
Nebiu.
or Nebiu. Sorry,
So it's
sorry for my
Nebi
pronunciation.
and the Her, there is indeed also a very interesting hierarchy among the goldsmiths or the gold workers. So there is one group of persons that are called simply nebbio, gold workers. Right. Mm-hmm. Then we have another hierarchy level, heri nebbio, so the chiefs of the gold workers. And then we have even imira nebbio, meaning overseers of the nebbio. So, and this is top, an top, interesting fact that particularly also in this context of the specialists that were able to process all the gold that was sourced in the mines along the eastern desert, or particularly also in ancient Nubia in two larger regions, that there is a certain hierarchy among those craftspeople.
I understand. Great. And so, you know, the gold was a very important element for the growth and development of the dynasty. And Egypt had to import quite a lot of goods because, you know, it was a very rich country, but they were missing some important elements like spices, for example, some mordants that were utilized for the classic fabric, some horses for the cavalry, very, very important. And as we mentioned before, for the wood, because Egypt has a little bit of wood, but you know, the top quality was imported first. Second, the wood that was utilized by the navy, either the military navy and the commercial fleet, had to be imported mainly from Lebanon, from a classic area. In fact, we can remember that even during the Ottoman period, they had always the same problem. So they had to import wood from either from the regions north of Greece or from Africa, because all the Ottoman Empire had the same problem. And the same is also for the Romans. They had to import from the northern regions of Europe, and it is a determinant factor for the power. In addition, clearly gold was utilized to buy the sympathy, call it like this, of some populations, or in other cases, really to finance the real war, the activity. So it means gold that was utilized to pay mercenaries fighting in two regions where the Egyptian dynasty had a big development. That is the eastern part of Libya and the Levantine area, that is around Israel, just to make in fact, you know, by sure you are going to mention Megiddo, that is an important
the Battle of Megiddo by Tutmosis III. Yeah.
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. I just want to also, for our visitors, a little bit come back to what the New Kingdom is. Here we are talking about the time between 1550 to 1070 BC, and we Egyptologists are also then used to subdivide this period into three dynasties, the 18th, the 19th, and the 20th dynasty. And Alessandro also mentioned already the Battle of Megiddo, so one key military event under Tutmosis III.
Right.
And this is then indeed part of this military expansion of the Egyptian state towards the north in order to get also into contact or get access to all the also prestige goods also other resources available in this region. And the same then more or less applies in the south, so the region of Nubia, which is the larger region along the Nile, south of modern Aswan, where also the first kings of the Egyptians 18th dynasty started with a number of military campaigns, one after the other, more or less territorialize and colonialize this.
And getting one cataract after the other, up to the fifth cataract, yes, that is very, very important.
And indeed, particularly the area of Nubia is the one which is one central landscape that is known for gold. But speaking of gold, one also needs to consider always that in Egypt itself, so along the eastern desert, in the eastern desert hills, there is also there are well-known huge concentrations of Egyptian gold mining sites. So, speaking of gold, then indeed the eastern desert regions and two regions in ancient Nubia were the main sourcing areas for this gold.
Right.
And I might also just briefly add element that gold indeed played a key role for the development and the splendor and the military might and power of the New Kingdom, but also as economists and social anthropologists, we should never forget also the role of the backbone of Egyptian economy, which is the agriculture. And this is indeed the factor that allowed also Egypt and the New Kingdom to create all the resources, to create all the manpower, to have all these needed things, both in terms of people, of craftspeople who would build and make all these military paraphernalia. And what we know, at least from Egyptian documents and the evidence, is that grain is also among the main means of currency or sure. payment. So gold is indeed one element that plays a role in state context, in the elite sphere, as a means of showing off, of the state presenting itself, of the state.
So a marketing of the image.
A market, but also within Egypt, you know, in order to to furnish the temples with golden doors or gold doors cast.
In fact, as you know, the gold was a product, this destiny, this to, that was with a destiny for the pharaoh.
Yes, because as we know, all resources in terms of natural resources and of mineral resources in Egyptian state ideology belonged to Pharaoh. So he
property,
is the key key player in this. And he
an
had
owner,
then,
an owner yes, also.
He then had his agents that were in the individual regions in charge of the sourcing and all the planning of either proper state-run expeditions into the Nubian, into the gold-bearing regions in order to mine the gold, or also in more informal ways that people that are that were living in this region, also nomads that were knowledgeable about the areas or that were also knowledgeable about the technologies, how to extract gold from these quartz, how the Egyptian state in the end could make use of all this, and how in the end a huge part of the gold that was produced was indeed flowing into the Egyptian
treasury.
Yeah,
absolutely. And you know, something that I guess that we need to be a little bit more precise, the gold had two origins. One was a classic mine, so the quartz, and people were just taking out the stones, breaking the stones, and after treating the gold with the water, etc. And the second important source of gold was the alluvial gold. That means something that you find. So we may think of the miners in California in 1849 that were just collecting gold, or even in Africa, the western part of Africa, where the gold is. Is not dug. Mm. It is gold that is just collected by this kind of and something that I would like to remind you. Remember that we have the Jason,
the golden fleece.
Yes. Absolutely. You anticipated me. Thank you. And as you know, it was one of the technique because they were putting all this kind of animal
hide skin, sheep
skin,
particularly,
the sheep's mainly. Collecting in the water all the gold, putting this kind of very important element to the sun so it was bright, and after they were burning this kind of very important collector of gold and getting out the gold. Yeah, and so, you know, when we think of the Jason and all the mythology around, it is something that it is true in the region where he was, he had his experience. It's still a very important, even right now, region for gold mining. And so quite a lot of mythology. It is not only invention of the human being, but it is a transformation of the reality.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, something I would like to remind is that we have, and I'm just taking my notes, we had a period that started with the Koptos gold. It was really called Koptos gold, so on the northern part of
Nebu and Gebdeyu.
Yes, absolutely. After the Wanat, maybe. And the last part is the Kush, that is the...
The gold of Koptos, the gold of Wawat,
and
the gold of Kush.
Sorry for the pronunciation.
That's why I'm here as the Egyptologist.
Exactly.
So to support.
And so, you know, we had the three phases that are very, very important. And as soon, and we are already in the 19th dynasty, the Kash was partially abandoned. They had some troubles.
Because this is a bit also debated because since now in the last 15 years, the archaeology of Nubia has properly picked up thanks to, in particular in Sudan, mm-hmm. which is now the modern state, in which lots of ancient Nubia is located, thanks to a number of international funding projects. And whereas in the 50s, 60s, 70s, we didn't really know that much about the later mm-hmm. New Kingdom. So indeed, the 19th dynasty, sure. and particularly 20th dynasty in Sudan, there was the idea of the depopulation of this region, which is not totally true. Not the current understanding. But mm-hmm. we also need to think, also in archaeology, we think in particular epistemes. So there are waves of thinking, and based on the different available types of evidence, we as archaeologists or cultural historians sure. create an image or our understanding, current understanding about these regions. So we know a little bit more now also about the, let's say, demographic
evolution.
Reality, let's sure. say, of Nubia, particularly in the later Ramesside period, so the later 20th dynasty, and was not depopulated. But what we know also, let's say, we don't have that much archaeological and epigraphical evidence. This is maybe more the methodological issue, that in this period, those people living there, decorating the temples, being buried, leaving texts and other information, don't really focus on their jobs, on their daily routine of what they were, what kind of jobs they had, because in this period, they followed a different kind of mindset and understanding, mm. whereas in the 18th dynasty in Egypt, it was key for an elite person to boast and show off in his tomb who he was, in which kind of relationship he was mm. with the king, what his kind of economic standing was.
Really, and political marketing.
And it's then a different kind of time. You mentioned an amazing thing, namely the Golden Fleece, and in order to provide also a bit of historical context, it indeed seems that the first gold sourcing activities were just gold finding
collection
in the alluvial gold.
Exactly. Alluvial, yes.
What is interesting, this is something that I was asking myself, also looking at the material culture, so the objects that were used for this, I don't know of any kind of gold pen for this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. No one among my colleagues that are specialized in ceramics mentioned this. I wonder if this kind of penning technique would have been really used. We should know what kind of ceramic vessels were used. So I completely understand the point, and I also am sure that this was, let's say, the initial part of sourcing gold, but on the other hand, we still are lacking so much information about it. Then on the other hand, you mentioned also the proper quartz veins that were followed, and obviously this was a technique that was then mainly developed in the so-called Old and Middle Kingdom, also using dolerite hammers and following geological indications, because the ancient Egyptians had people that they called cementio prospectors, so people that were knowledgeable also about the local geology, particularly in the eastern desert. They were roaming the land and were really trying to find all the proper gold-bearing quartz veins, and also did some tests and surveys, and when they seemed to be promising, they then triggered the whole creation of an Egyptian state-run expedition to work on these. And then next to the alluvial gold or the placer gold and the quartz vein gold, it seems that particularly also in ancient Nubia, another methodology was used, which has been called wadi workings, mm-hmm. which is also something that is faster and easier and doable by a larger workforce. Therefore, maybe also the increase in gold production in the New Kingdom, because this is a technology of gold sourcing particularly known from this period, which means that along the wadi ground, so the dried out riverbeds in the desert, all the quartz and all the eroded stone that was eroded through the millennia from the surrounding rock collected and on the ground, and then the Egyptians just, let's say, walked over these, picked up the quartz bearing larger pieces or smaller ones, and then could process them easier while not doing all this hard labor
with the proper mine and the hammer.
So it's indeed also possible that particular mining approaches lead to a particular increase also in gold production, which we then see in the New Kingdom, and which then allows New Kingdom, Egypt of the New Kingdom, to receive all this.
Have a strong benefit.
To receive all this gold as a proper state organized income on the one hand, on the other hand, as tributes by those people living there, so as also political gifts. You are now under the control of Egypt, meaning you need to pay us taxes. And then also, as I already mentioned, through maybe more informal market ways, because we are also not sure what kind of private market or trade barter exchange really did happen in the New Kingdom, and which other ways of gold, the gold might have been tackled through these or from these regions.
Sure.
Via informal trade networks into the hands of the Egyptians.
Right, and you know, I'm thinking now maybe we could talk about the silver and gold ratio, because you know, Egypt has a small quantity of silver that was in reality the normal way to trade quite a lot of goods. You mentioned gold as an important image of gold. Copper, clearly, bronze and silver were like in the structure of the currency method of payment, and it is important because you know a lot of silver had to be imported. Some of the gold was containing some silver, so it was taken out of the gold. But a lot of gold or silver had to be imported. And the silver at that time was coming mainly from the mines in Spain. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I know that, for example, the Phoenician merchants, much later, were this is the point, were used to buy silver in Spain, and a certain kind of price, and selling the same silver, getting much more gold, because at one point the ratio gold to silver was 1 ounce of silver per 2 ounces of gold. That is incredible. While the region in Mesopotamia that has a large amount of silver in the Iran mines right now, so in Persian mining area, they had a lot of silver, so the prices there were something like 1 ounce of gold per 10, 12 ounces of silver. So it was a very profitable business. And this is important to keep in mind, because it means that at that time, the trading was a very important element, but not like right now. No, right now, for example, if you can see in the market a big difference like this, you click on your computer and you buy this and you sell that. At that time, it was much more difficult, and also the transportation was much, much longer. So it means that it was an important element, but not for big, big volumes, a big size. But slowly, the silver came to Egypt, and so the ratio changed very rapidly, 1 to 1, and after it was 1 to 2, exactly on the other side.
1 to 1, I also read also a little bit in preparation that there was even some colleagues said that indeed there are, now, but we can maybe speak later also about the particular gold qualities that we know, because there are more or less three kind of qualities.
Sure.
But I wanted to simply come back to the silver and your mentioning of the origin in Spain. But this is then not something that we can in any way securely relate to our
to
time.
That time. Later.
Okay, very important. Because when we talk about silver in Egypt, then it seems that most of the Egyptian silver is actually a natural alloy Of silver and gold.
Of silver and gold, a mixture, right, exactly.
So the type of gold that was sourced was not always gold, but sometimes had indeed more ratio of silver.
Right,
was then,
and it was whiter, much
whiter. It was whiter, indeed,
exactly.
And this is then something that
in
we
fact,
are coming...
You know, but you know me, that we had the first coin that was traded in northern part of near Troy, was a mixture of the two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And which is then also another, let's say, metallurgical thing that we are used to call electrum.
Right. In fact,
also
I'm talking the
alloy
about the electrum.
Of silver,
but natural mixture of the two. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Because it seems that all the silver that was sourced in the eastern desert and Nubia was indeed coming from the Egyptian gold mines. Mm-hmm. And there are colleagues who don't really want to call it silver, but they want to call it Aurean silver.
Mm-hmm.
Aurean silver.
Aurean, sure.
So indeed, next to the silver coming from gold mines, there also might be a little bit of more, I don't want to say pure silver, but let's say silver with the indeed higher content of silver in connection to other elements such as gold. But it might also be possible that also lead ores, such as galena,
mm-hmm. galena.
Were then also treated in order to extract the minute amounts of silver in the lead, in the galena. However, it seems that the silver contents in this galena, at least from our modern perspective, don't seem to be high enough for a successful also economically mm-hmm. viable. Undertaking. Mentioning silver, obviously, a key find is the Etot treasure.
Right.
So if we talk about silver, we just need to mention
mechanically.
This.
Mechanically, so, we fall there.
You know, a selection of silver objects that were cached or ritually buried in a temple of Etot in Egypt to hide them away. And it seems indeed that most of the silver, if we understand the methods of provenancing, right, comes from Syria. So has this origin from Syria. But anyway, silver was in the Old and Middle Kingdom also far more exceptional and rare. But it seems that in the New Kingdom, so the time that we are talking about, it's not so such an exceptional material because we know that, for instance, in Ramesside times, Ramses III, there are texts that speak of several hundred kilograms of silver statuary in temples. So mm-hmm. there must have been a huge number of cult statues made in silver in those temples, which obviously did not survive
right.
Until today. So also here we are always... we need to rely on these sources. Then in silver, also the Bubastis treasure, another find of famous silver vessels from the late New Kingdom. Here we are really talking 19th dynasty, 20th dynasty,
also with the connection found
in the Egyptian Nile Delta with this kind of international style and trade. So it's a wonderful find. And then if we even go on later, in the 21st dynasty, so the kings of Tani, so the Psusenna sarcophagus fully made in silver, so we have then also lots of objects in silver. And me as a curator at the Museo Idizio, I'm also currently working on the copper alloy metal vessels from the tomb of Ra, so from the, mm-hmm. The tomb TT8 that was found undisturbed by Ernesto Schiaparelli in 1906. There is a huge set of copper alloy vessels for drinking and for cooking and for other things, but among them also three silver vessels, which then obviously stand out, but don't maybe create such an extraordinary value as we might think. But this is again always the question, which kind of evidence, meaning epigraphical evidence, so what kind of original Egyptian texts we read and how we are going to read them and interpret them and what kind of different questions we have
right,
in them,
right.
obviously. Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, I think really more and more that the gold played an important role for this kind of dynasty, and I have found some statistics about the annual production that is estimated up to 1,000 kilos. So it seems a small quantity. But keep in mind that right now we have a mining production of roughly 2,500 tons, I'm talking tons right now, of gold
worldwide. Okay,
And something that we need to keep in mind, the ratio, so the quantity of gold that people are right now extracting from 1 ton of mineral, it is between 4 and 5 grams per 1 ton. Incredible.
You mean 1 ton of quartz, 1 ton of rock,
Exactly. And in Australia, they are able to work, and this is incredible, at 0.5 gram per ton. And they are making money because, you know, they are trading gold at around $1,900 and they are producing at 17, 18. So it is a very profitable business.
Also economically viable,
But keep in mind, 0.5 gram is incredible. But keep in mind also that, for example, right now, in the case of copper, people are trading, are producing copper with a ratio of something like 4 kilos per ton. So it is not a tremendous amount. And 20, 30 years ago, this kind of grade, that is the technical word, grade, was in the region of 7 to 8.
Okay.
The same for gold, 7 to 8. Something like in 1980s, the level was in the region of real 7 to 8, and now has been cut by two, really cut in two parts. And it is something that we need to keep in mind. Absolutely, exactly.
Speaking about these numbers, and returning to the New Kingdom, so there are wonderful, and there's a wonderful document, the so-called Annals of Thutmose III, that are carved in the Karnak Temple, and that record the individual yearly tributes that were tributed by the surrounding countries to Egypt under the reign of Thutmose III. And there is one particular in the later years, so the years between 34 and 42 in his reign, we have information about the yearly tribute coming from both Wawad, so meaning Lower Nubia, and also Kush, meaning Upper Nubia. So this might be then interesting to put this into context and also to provide, let's say, a general understanding how much gold was in this, was within 1 year mined and sourced and delivered to the treasury of the state, meaning the pharaoh. And these numbers range between 220 and 280 kilograms per year for Wawad. And for Kush, it's between 9 kilograms to 27 per year, which is quite a lot, but also not that much. And these are then some numbers that we archaeologists and economists need to take into consideration when we want to estimate the general gold production, because this is, let's say, only what the Egyptian state was able to receive or get as an income of tributes. Because on the other hand, we know that the Egyptian pharaohs spent far more gold than they received from those quarries or that are listed in those texts for their own temples. We know, for instance, that Hatshepsut donates 4,000 kilograms of gold to the Temple of Amun. Thutmose III to the Amun Temple of Karnak as well, 13,000 kilograms. Amenhotep III, so the father of Akhenaton and one of those kings of the New Kingdom, who's also in most cases always connected with the peak of splendor in the New Kingdom. There is one inscription that says that he gifted or donated 5,157 kilograms of gold to the Temple of Mont. So there is intense use of gold within Egypt for furnishing the temples, which can be gilding doors, which can be statues of gold, which can be cult paraphernalia in gold, which can be statues of the king himself, mm-hmm. also gilt or gold, or in gold, or other kind of elements of the, let's say, the monumental display of those kings.
Symbol of power, right.
Yeah, in indeed showing off. So, and then on the other hand, we have Ramses III, and we are then in the 20th dynasty, but he still donates 4,600 kilograms of gold mm-hmm. to various temples. So there is still gold available. And this is then also something that we might add to the discussion. On the one hand, new gold from the Eastern Desert and from the two regions in Nubia is coming in, and also as tributes from Syria, because also we know after the Megiddo battle, right. Also lots of gold has been gifted to Egypt in form of tribute to Thutmose III, that next to this, let's say, newly incoming sourced gold with proper state-run expeditions and state-run undertakings, that there's also lots of gold that is in circulation from all the gold-rich periods before.
Sure,
so gold the is new very kingdom stable. Is also, let's say, riding on the wave of gold availability from gold available in Old Kingdom context and Middle Kingdom context and later.
I have just a question that is, the temple, mm-hmm. temples mm-hmm. probably, mm-hmm. had a lot of gold.
Yes.
And what was utilized for? Mainly kept inside for statues, etc., or some gold was maybe spent to feed people, to because you know we know that some religious people were trading overseas. They mm-hmm. were international merchants mm-hmm. in reality. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So maybe some gold was kept inside clearly, some was maybe spent outside mm-hmm. to import quite a lot of goods that Egypt needed.
I think in this regard, we can immediately also pinpoint the kind of diplomatic exchange between Egypt and the Near Eastern vassal states or kingdoms, Babylonia, Assyria, and the other states, city-states in the region, because when we think that gold in Egypt is a state-owned property, I think it's also more indeed the state, namely Pharaoh mm-hmm. and his administration, that uses this gold as the diplomatic means of exchange. And we indeed are well aware of this interesting exchange of gold, thanks to the Amarna letters, Amenhotep III on the one hand, and also Akhenaten, where we have the diplomatic correspondence of the Egyptian royal household with all the kingdoms in the ancient Near East, so in the Levant and in Syria, and in which we read about this envy of those states. They think Egypt is the most gold-rich country because there is one phrase, one vassal king says, in Egypt, gold can be picked up like dust from the street, so send me more.
Send me more. Mm-hmm. Right.
And there's also another textual reference in which one Burnaburiash, I think, complains that the predecessor of the king that he's currently writing sent him more gold. And he complains, why did you only send me two mines of gold now?
Sure, it's nothing.
Please send me more.
Sure.
And interestingly, he then also says, if you send me more, please let me know what I can send you in exchange. And this is then indeed this diplomatic and state-run trade exchange at the highest level, where really the gold is a key player and factor that created and sustained this flow over the decades.
Right. Yeah. I would like now to talk about maybe the really extraction of gold and the very poor conditions of the people that were miners, but they were very often slaves.
I would not say slaves, I would say forced laborers.
Because
the term slave in ancient Egypt has a different
meaning.
So it seems that, let's say, based on our evidence, we as Egyptologists are used to more say forced laborers and less use the concept of slaves that is more known from the, let's say, Roman and world, true. Which is then a different kind of possession of the person or the possession of the labor
or
force.
Or the labor force, the right, person. Exactly. But you know, we know that to get gold, you need to have a lot of water. Mm-hmm. And very often in the desert, the water was shared between the labor force mm-hmm. and the gold production and the scriba.
And the donkeys, not to forget.
And the donkeys also, because they need to drink. very often, you know, people were suffering very heavily because, you know, they didn't get enough water, mainly in the desert, under the sun, etc. Mm-hmm. And the dilemma, not a personal dilemma, but the natural dilemma for the scriba and the people that were in charge of the mining, they had to choose what to do, keep in mind that very often they had an order coming out from the pharaoh, saying, I want you to give me a certain amount of gold, more or less.
Maybe, yeah, but they were, let's say, tasked to lead this expedition and plan it accordingly so that it would return successfully. But thankfully, there are two texts from the New Kingdom, so the 19th dynasty. One is the famous stela of Seti I at Wadi Qanais in the Wadi Mia temple, where the king himself is described in court discussing with his officials, and he, Seti I himself, wants to make sure that the miners that are sent to the Wadi Baramiya and the region east of Edfu to mine gold are properly watered and treated. And he led also a well being dug properly at the site so that there is water. Mm-hmm. But he also had a particular interest in this because it was the time when Seti I built his own funerary temple at Abydos. So all these gold workers that were tasked in the Wadi Baramiya to source and mine the gold, all this gold was supposed to immediately go to the building project of Abydos. So he had this direct interest in facilitating and supporting and provisioning, helping. Providing right. for this particular workforce. Then there's another famous text on the so-called Kuban stela, now in Grenoble, that was found in the fortress of Kuban that was built by Sesostris I at the mouth of the Wadi Alaki. And this is a text in which also the king Rameses II is presented in an audience at Memphis, and in which some of his administrators tell him in the region of Akita, which is the Wadi of Wadi Alaki, there is water is lacking. Mm. When we send our gold miners to the Wadi with the donkeys, only a half of them returns because there is a lack of water.
Lack of water, sure.
But Rameses II says, okay, this is something that needs to change because he himself obviously is also interested in the constant flow of gold being sourced there. So he tasks his viceroy, Heckernacht, to oversee the digging of a well in the Wadi Alaki at Ashira, at the specific space or spot. And indeed, also in the text, it mentions a well is dug and in several meters depth, water appears. Obviously, it is culturally considered as the deed of God and of Ramses II himself in choosing this spot. So he, as a godlike king is the one who made this water appearing. It seems also that particularly in Wadi Alaki, there might even have been more wells all along the Wadi leading to the main site, campsite, where we then also have the habitation places of all the workers in the dry stone huts that are marked with these kind of millstones. So we have also the toolkit of the gold processing that indeed there is a system of wells, but in the Kuban stela, we also learned that water was sent with the workers in animal hides.
Sure, hides, clear.
To the mines. And since we are also here, let's say, not really close, but there might also be a constant flow of water, of goods, of provision between the mines and Kuban formed. Mm-hmm. So donkeys from Kuban were sending water, food, fuel and other things to the mines,
bring him back.
And in return, you know, all the gold dust that this has been produced is being sent back to Kuban, and then only at Kuban is being melted into ingots and is then sent to the treasury of Pharaoh.
So you would say that probably during the Egyptian time, the conditions of workers were a shade better versus the Roman time.
This is indeed, you are mentioning the perfect example. It's the question, do we read Agatharchides when we read Agatharchides, do we read him as a testimony of this Greek-Roman?
It is a real photographer or...
Or can we also methodologically, let's say, think about the same working conditions in the ancient times? I completely agree with you that working conditions in those mines were far from ideal. This was not a relaxing life, because this was a life constantly under the pressure of working, of hammering, of dust, of dirt, of noise, of people running, shouting, activity. So we also need to think a little bit about
something
the
that is very bad
lived
is,
experience.
Is,
health conditions. Yeah,
right. Exactly.
Kind of.
And imagine when you dig, they had the light that was in reality burning oxygen.
Yes.
And so people were suffering quite a lot of troubles in the respiration.
Yeah.
And it was a very bad condition.
This is then also a very interesting question, whether the fuel used in these mining sites is locally cut wood, or is wood that is also of any kind of fuel that is sent to the mines.
Mm-hmm.
Next to the use of wood, fresh wood, there might be the use of charcoal, you mentioned it earlier.
Right.
And then it seems also that dried donkey dung is a possible is a possible resource for kind of fire.
A poor one, because it's not... is not a very good production of energy, but it works. It works.
It also then depends in which context you need the fire, because the idea has also been pronounced that also in those underground mines, also fire setting was practiced in order to set fire to the face of the stone break it loose after. Cool water on it, but I'm skeptical, because we don't really have that much evidence. No. I'm more in favor of proper Egyptian handiwork with dollar reed hammers and stone hammers really crashing these quartz veins, both in the underground, both in the
And the hammers
mines.
Were mainly copper or bronze or...
Wonderful question. We know of from the archaeological evidence that was also particularly
heavy stones
collected by the couple Rosemarie and Dietrich Klemm from Munich. Mm-hmm. They did this survey in the eastern desert and also Nubia, and they found these that long and that wide dolerit hammer, so of a particular type of hard stone that we also know was used in Egyptian stone quarries to pulverize the stone. And next to this, it seems that also the use of copper alloy chisels, meaning bronze chisels, in the New Kingdom might have been used.
But at that time, iron
was not yet present.
Exactly.
No, iron has only been properly introduced in the Persian period. So
right.
No.
Exactly.
And this is then the interesting context also in terms of economy. So how much resources does the Egyptian state need to spend to send such an expedition, so such a proper state-run expedition that is properly planned, in which 100 to 1,000 or even more people participate to these kind of locations in the eastern desert or the Wadi Al-Laki.
It is really an investment.
The companies right now
have to choose the same.
Yeah.
How much do I want to spend? And I am not so sure to get all the gold I hope to get.
Yes, yes.
So it is a risky activity, right? Yeah.
And then also the question is then maybe the Egyptian mindset was potentially also not so much looking for economic benefit. So it was not we spend that much resources and we need to get that much money or gold back. Because the significance of gold was different. It had a different kind of use context in ritual, in magical, in temple context. So it didn't really need to be economically balanced. So the money you spend is something that you need to get in return in the investment. Right. Because as I said earlier, I think that the backbone of Egyptian economy is the agriculture. And if this works,
still,
then everything, right, everything is, let's say, our secondary dimensions of how this state handled its economy.
Sure. And the Nile was really the key element,
yes,
once more.
Yes, the key element, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But the conditions of the work people in these mines were harsh. And you also mentioned the question of fuel. I mentioned the potential use of donkey dungs also in this context. And also, I want to add another, let's say, group of people, namely the local people living in this region. Mm-hmm. So the what we are used to call nomads, or the Beja people, the Blemis. So all those people who populated those desert regions, they seem to be the people who had the knowledge about the landscape.
Sure.
So once the Egyptians could cooperate with them, they could then show them around. And they may be also in those periods during which Egypt didn't have territorial control or proper state control over those regions, were continuing with the gold processing and gold sourcing and processing. So on the one hand, we know Old Kingdom individual expeditions into the Eastern Desert, in the Middle Kingdom as well, the Middle Kingdom, and also with the fortresses, the chain of fortresses at the Second Cataract, so with the interest of the Middle Kingdom state in resources from Nubia, among them gold, and then with the New Kingdom, proper political control and colonization of this region, also in bad terms. But in those intermediate periods, these regions were not under the control of Egypt.
Big question mark in reality.
And since there were people living there, it seems that they also then continued with maybe smaller scale gold extraction, but...
Sure. And I have a question. You know, you have a very important map of the gold mines.
Oh, yeah.
According to me, it is the only one existing.
Yeah.
And do you have any idea whether there are other potential that are still missing, or... So it is the only one, or you think that probably they had other
probably other. I'm convinced that they had a huge set of maps.
Sure.
I think the Turin gold mine papyrus is the only one surviving.
Only one known and surviving.
But right, the fact that this kind of topographical map that shows the Wadi Hammamat and a particular area about the Wadi Sid, with the stela of Seti II, mm-hmm, a well dug next to it, the indicated workman settlement, and then also these darker hills in which it says hills in which gold and silver are sourced or washed. So there is indeed so much also knowledge in terms of how to map, how to conceptualize,
so they had some experience,
such a landscape. And I think these kind of maps, on the one hand, were maybe the result of these cementiu, those prospectors, sure, that we know, that particularly we know more from the Old and Middle Kingdoms in the epigraphic record, that were sent out to the desert in order to find those viable quartz veins. But I'm sure there was also a map of the whole Wadi Hammamat, because these are only parts, and also of the Wadi Baramiya, of the Wadi Alaki, of the Wadi Gabgaba, also maybe of the proper gold of Kush region, the region close to the New Kingdom pharaonic foundation, such as Sai, Soleb, Tombos, Amara West. So this region, mm-hmm, in which, by the way, also gold sourcing and extracting is a little bit simpler, because there the Precambrian basement complex and all the gold-bearing quartz veins and all the eroded quartz lying on the surface is far closer to the Nile, so there is less expenditure necessary in order to...
And I haven't seen the map, but do they indicate the different kind of gold? That means, I don't think.
Right. Not in this map, because it says only this is the place of Neb, and it's the Juwab, it's the pure mountain.
Pure mountain. Sorry.
But which is a general term also for a religiously significant space or spot in ancient Egypt, but not necessarily only related to gold. But this little thing triggers to only briefly come back to the three gold qualities that are known, since you mentioned it. There is a Nebu Nefer, so a good or perfect gold. There is a simple Nebu gold. And then there is the Nebu Hedge, so the bright or white gold. And this
the
is
the whiter one.
The whiter
so silver,
gold.
More
so these are then, let's say, terms that seem to allow us to understand a little bit more how the ancient Egyptians themselves differentiated between the gold qualities. Because nowadays we can use modern methods of analysis. Sure. We know about the exact percentage of gold, silver, copper, and all the other kind of elements inside.
So I would like to just to conclude and remind the fact that Nubia and the eastern part of Nubia, between Nubia and the Red Sea, were at that time probably the major gold producer of the world, known world at that time. And this is something that really I am still thinking when I am looking to the gold I have on my fingers. And this may come from that period. Maybe, I don't know. We know that gold is very stable. And we know that the total amount of gold in the world right now, it is something like 102,000 tons of gold that was dug in the past. And gold is very stable. So, you know, you can't throw gold out of the window, yes, but someone will collect it, or maybe 20 centuries after it'll be still used.
Yeah.
So, you know, Nubia is a very, very important element in the economic history.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that you have much more information than I have.
Yeah, and speaking also about gold and the stable and the value and the magical appeal of gold, we didn't really speak about the color, the gold, the shininess, and indeed also the stableness of gold, which is part of this kind of
mystery,
fascination or interest of pharaonic culture in the use of gold, particular for these elite settings, for the kings, for royal statues, because as you are well aware, the Egyptians considered gold the flesh of the
flesh
gods,
of God.
And silver the bones of the gods. So there is always this magical
attraction
or significance behind
but
the
gold. But this is still, I'm sorry to remind you, that the central banks right now own something like 35,000 tons of gold in the vaults. So still valid now. So 4,000 years after.
But this is then gold that is kept in the banks, in the vaults, and the gold in Egypt had a particular way of being used and shown and displayed.
Right.
Maybe less so in terms of the treasure of Tutankhamun, because all the gold that he was equipped with was made in the workshop of the Karnak Temple, maybe. Because the temple was the place in which all the gold was collected, administered, and where also the best artisans of their time were working. And with the tomb treasure of Tutankhamun, of the boy king Tutankhamun, we also see and understand what kind of cultural significance gold had, particularly in outfitting a dead king for the transformation into the afterlife, or the maintenance and permanence in the afterlife. So all the gold in Tutankhamun's tomb plays this role of ritually and magically outfitting the king with all this kind of stable and magic power that gold provides. And since we also earlier mentioned a number of numbers or values, I want to remind that indeed the famous death mask of Tutankhamun weighs 11 kilograms, so there's lots of gold involved. There are also some precious stones, but let's say the main body of this object is 11 kilograms of gold, whereas the huge golden sarcophagus weighs up to 110 kilograms of gold. And these are only two examples of far more gold or also gilt objects from the tomb of Tutankhamun, which again then brings us back to our main topic, so that the gold supported, helped Egypt in terms of economy, also in terms of its monumental display and in the use of gold for all these indeed temple rituals, for the outfittings of the dead kings, because the tomb treasure of Tutankhamun is only the tomb treasure of Tutankhamun which survived. We need to imagine that all the other kings of the new kingdom were equipped with the same, or even larger amount.
Even larger, maybe larger, of
treasure. And so, coming back to this question, how much gold was sourced in Nubia, in the eastern desert, and elsewhere, and how much gold the Egyptian state, then transformed into those funerary objects that, so to say, were meant to be cut off the circulation. There's a huge expenditure and, as we say, conspicuous consumption happening. Mm. It has been estimated that 12 to 18 tons of gold were produced during the whole New Kingdom, which might seem a little bit small as an amount, but this is only what has been produced, and it doesn't include all the gold that has been sourced and produced in the periods earlier.
Right.
And this is then also part of the appeal of the gold today that you mentioned in showing your finger ring, because today, given the simple possibility of melting, remelting gold, and much of the gold from the other tombs of the kings was robbed and was remelted and found its way in different forms and formats and tools and statues and whatever into the future circulation, which was not deposited in any tomb, but it's still then in circulation and might constitute some of the gold ingots that are currently in any kind of bank in the world, but might indeed also constitute maybe not the full share of your gold ring, but a small part of it. And in this way, the gold of Egypt is still in a way, or might still be
alive,
all around us, and is still alive, and therefore still creates this fascination and attraction.
Okay, vielen Dank.
Vielen Dank, es war mir eine große Freude, mit dir heute gesprochen zu haben.
Danke.